Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Texas has always loomed large in the American imagination, but how big a deal are the state and its leaders in the nation's capital? It's still early, but there are indications that the 2016 Republican presidential primary could have as many as five candidates with ties to the state. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush was born here. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul grew up here. Senator Ted Cruz represents the state. And, of course, there is former Texas Governor Rick Perry, who is always eager to have what's been dubbed the Texas miracle of outsized economic growth and job creation discussed on a national stage. And on the Democratic side, Elizabeth Warren spent more than a decade in Houston and Austin. She says she won't challenge Hillary Clinton, but a number of progressives wish she would. It's likely that candidates from both parties, with and without the ability to claim Texas as home, will make plenty of visits over the next year and a half in search of campaign money. Texas has some of the country's highest rates of undocumented and uninsured residents, an 800-mile international border, and many struggling schools. It also led the nation in job creation last year, has a relatively low cost of living, and, it turns out, a very large supply of natural gas. So what does that add up to? My guests today are well positioned to explain how Texas is viewed by power brokers in Washington, D.C. Abby Livingston is originally from Fort Worth. She is Washington correspondent for the Texas Tribune. Todd Gilman is Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you for having me.
That's great to be here.
So does the Washington establishment get Texas? How accurate are perceptions by leaders outside the state of the economy, the culture, the laws in Texas?
I think the establishment totally gets it. It's just known as the ATM, not just for Republicans, but also as Democrats, that, you know, there's often talk of, you know, when so-and-so comes through Dallas or comes through Houston or Austin, because they will be kissing the ring of donors and fundraisers and things like that. So and we're not that far out from the Bush administration, the second one. So Texas, I first moved here in 2006, and Texas dominated the city at that point. And I, you know, it changed once President Bush left somewhat. Our presence was diminished, but we also have a massive delegation. John Cornyn is the Senate Majority Whip. So Texas is pretty pervasive. You can't miss it too much in the city.
And of course, the other senator is no shy, retiring violet.
So, of course.
Yes, I think Abby's right. I don't know if you would say the establishment in Washington really gets Texas. I mean, does anybody really get Texas, even Texans? There are so many Texases, but there's no escaping Texas in Washington, that's for sure.
Lots of people in Texas have expressed concern that U.S. Customs and Border Protection has not done enough to secure that 800-mile border we share with Mexico. What's the perception in Washington of calls for state and local agencies to take on a greater role in preventing unauthorized border traffic?
I'll jump in. Actually, even more interesting than Washington is I was up in New Hampshire about a month ago, and that was the dominant issue. And I mean, I looked up how far New Hampshire is from Texas, and I want to say it was like 1,300, not even 30, it was much farther than that, but thousands of miles away. And that was the dominant issue at town halls where Rick Perry and Ted Cruz were appearing. And so it is a major issue in the Republican Party, and I think it is in Washington, but also in the most random places in the country.
Yeah, no, there's no question that border issues, border security was the deal killer when it came to comprehensive immigration reform. That was something that way back in the day, probably around the time that Abby got to D.C., that was a John Cornyn thing. He was really for comprehensive immigration reform until he wasn't, until there was an enormous pushback that had to do with border security. And the consensus within the Republican Party right now clearly, and Marco Rubio is hitting his head up against this because he did support the bipartisan deal a couple of years ago and is paying for it in the primaries as he positions himself for 2016, that you have to have a security first before we move on to anything else. And Texas is ground zero for that fight, and Texans are front and center in that fight. We hear it from Ted Cruz when he pitches himself in New Hampshire, where I've also been, and Iowa and all around the country, that no, the country doesn't want comprehensive reform. He ducks the idea of what you do with the 11 or 12 million people who are already here. He focuses on what to do in terms of legal immigration, but pretty much across the board, all the Republicans, which are who controls Congress, and so the ones who control that part of the agenda, it's all about border security first. There's a huge amount of resentment, which we do see from the state level, that the federal government isn't doing enough. I was talking to Governor Abbott this weekend, and he talks about that, how many hundreds of millions of dollars, as Governor Perry has talked about, hundreds of millions Texas has had to spend because the federal government isn't spending it to secure the border and do its job. So it's a chronic friction point.
Of likely candidates with links to Texas, only Rand Paul and Ted Cruz have declared they are running. The others are in this what's called the exploratory phase. Are there limits on what candidates can do, how they can raise money, how much they can raise before they officially declare?
There is a big difference, and I don't know the legal ins and outs, but if you are a sitting member of Congress versus a governor or out-of-office politician. So if you are a senator, the restrictions are much tighter, which is probably why we saw those three guys get in, Rubio, Rand Paul, and Cruz. I won't claim to know the legal ends of this, and I've been meaning to get around to it, but the main thing is they cannot say I'm running for president. And so, but they are acting, these are, in all intents and purposes, campaigns that are running in these states.
Right, absolutely. And I, like Abby, I have been meaning to figure out the difference because it is almost a difference without a distinction. But one thing that I do know is there is an important distinction in terms of the super PACs. And Jeb Bush has been managing to exploit this issue. Once someone is a declared candidate, there has to be a very, very, very impenetrably high wall between any super PAC that supports them and their formal campaign apparatus. But until they're a formal declared candidate, they can have dinner, they can schmooze, they can travel around with people who might be involved with a super PAC who might eventually support them. And Jeb Bush has been doing that. So the game that a lot of these campaigns have been playing is to pick a very, very loyal, trusted advisor, someone who really knows the candidate's mind, who knows what would be good for the candidate or bad for the candidate, and install that person or team of people like that to run the supporting super PAC to raise unlimited sums of money. But at a certain point, you have to cut off ties and there can't be any even indirect coordination, wink, wink, in terms of messaging, in terms of ad placement or any of that stuff, where you put the grant, you know, should the super PAC that supports Ted Cruz that is going to have $30 million at least that we know of send ground troops to Iowa, for instance, or should they spend the money on ads in New Hampshire? Well, Cruz can't send any kind of signals to that effect. But he could have had those conversations 2 months ago with the people running it, and they kind of sketched it out maybe a little bit now. And that's
which is probably what happened. Is that what you're saying? Or any candidate?
We can only surmise, yes. Mm-hmm. The fact that, I mean, in Cruz's example, his college debate partner and roommate at college and law school is kind of calling the shots at the major. I mean, there's, you know, everyone knows what's going on, but the legal niceties, no doubt, are being taken care of.
What we may also see, which I saw during the midterms, and I was kind of a participant because they would communicate through the media. So, for instance, the head of the House Democratic political arm, Congressman Steve Israel, would complain about outside groups spending too much money on the Senate races and not the House races, Democratic-friendly ones. And so he would complain to reporters and, you know, I mean, that is news. And so we would write it up. And, you know, the hope was that the other groups would see it and go, oh, we should go spend money here. And so as reporters, we're sometimes complicit in the communication process. So
we're here. We're catalysts. This is our job. Well, and then there was the Mitch McConnell, the B-roll that John Stewart made
so
horrible fun of, where he just sat in front of a camera to make, I don't know. I don't know how you even describe it. Cutaway shots that could be used by anybody who happened to want to cut an ad for him. And there it is. There's video free for the taking for anyone who might want to cut a McConnell ad. And I'm not saying I want you to do this. I'm just saying here it is. Here's the transponder coordinates if you want to download it.
He's got that kind of extra time to make those. Yeah. All right. So Ted Cruz has enthusiastically thrown his hat into the ring. He's in there early. He's certainly making his presence known. He's had a really contentious relationship with the GOP establishment. Are there any signs that he's doing anything to repair that?
Oh, it's all a game. They love each other. They totally get. No, they don't. Not at all.
It's Senator Cruz certainly has burned some bridges within the establishment, but the way I look at it is there are just so many candidates running this time that this pie just gets sliced up in so many different ways. And so you may have five people splitting whatever, you know, you can get out of the establishment, whether it's endorsements or field organization or money. And Cruz is probably going to do fairly well with his small portion of the pie with anti-establishment conservatives. So the danger for him is if there are too many anti-establishment conservatives running as well. So
that's right. And so, you know, there are trade-offs to be had in all of these things. So Jeb Bush is the establishment choice, supposedly, or at least the biggest establishment choice, and that comes with a certain amount of money. And that's good for him, but the trade-off for him is he loses Tea Party support every time somebody says he is an establishment choice. The converse is true for Ted Cruz. So he is on the outs every time. Any listener out there who was thinking about Ted Cruz and didn't realize, I mean, I think everybody knows that he's on the outs with the GOP leadership for the most part. This reinforces his message. This is great for Ted Cruz. Every time his people that he is really trying to appeal to, at least at this phase of the primary, as Abby is saying, hear that McConnell hates him and that there's friction and he voted differently from John Cornyn, the number two Republican, and that people won't sit near him at the weekly policy lunches at the Senate, or that he skipped out on a vote. Whatever it is that is supposedly the kind of thing that you would think someone would go to the Senate to want to do, to build relationships, to build coalitions, to get legislation through, Everything that is the normal path for a senator, Cruz takes the opposite path. For maybe not everything, I'm exaggerating a little bit, as my kids say, you exaggerate all the time. but this is great. This just reinforces his message that he is the anti-establishment outside of Washington candidate. It reinforces his narrative. It fills his coffers, maybe not with so much money from bundlers, the ordinary, you know, CEO types, but if he can replace that with $100 donors, he's fine.
You all have both been on the, if we want to call it the campaign trail in Iowa and New Hampshire, or the exploratory trail, depending on who you're covering on any given day. How does Senator Cruz do at the sort of retail level, charisma dependent politics that happens in these places?
He's great. I mean, he's very good. He's not quite as good a glad hander as Rick Perry and maybe some of these other people who are just truly gifted retail politicians. Cruz's particular forte is giving a speech to a crowd that is a friendly crowd. We've both seen him. I think you were at the firefighters also, right?
Yes.
Not actually at the firefighters, but I watched the video of the firefighters where he gave his standard speech and it just fell flat. But if he's in front of a conservative crowd, man, their blood is a-boiling by the end of it. And he's quite good at that. I mean, really virtuoso good at that. He's got a tape recorder in his head that he never makes a mistake verbally. And even at the kissing babies, shaking hands, doing that kind of stuff, I think we've both seen it, and he's quite good at this.
We're speaking this hour with Todd Gilman, who is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, and Abby Livingston, Washington Correspondent for the Texas Tribune. We will continue our conversation about Texas and how it's perceived in the nation's capital in just a few minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. This, of course, is Think in D.C. Week. You can find us by following the hashtag on Twitter. You can also check out our Tumblr. It's at kerathink.tumblr.com. Back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with two journalists who cover D.C. for Texas-based publications. Abby Livingston is Washington correspondent for the Texas Tribune. Todd Gilman is Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. How is Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who grew up outside Houston, positioning himself to compete for Texas delegates?
He's fascinating. I went down to Fort Worth and Dallas in January and watched him speak to the two county GOP committees, and he did pretty well. What I gleaned from it was, should he survive the initial first few states, Nevada, New Hampshire, Iowa, and South Carolina, Texas is the next big state on the horizon, and it's the delegates will be awarded proportionately, so it's not winner take all. So Rand Paul can kind of, he doesn't need to win the whole state to walk away a winner from Texas. But the other interesting thing about him is his ties to Texas, even though they're decades old, still matter because he was able to poach the state GOP chairman to join his campaign. And there's also a digital strategist named Vincent Harris who worked for both Perry and Cruz who signed on with Senator Paul. And he basically told me part of it was because they both went to Baylor and he felt a loyalty in that direction. So there could be other reasons why that I don't know, but that's so I think he's playing hard for Texas and much more so than people realize.
And the state GOP chairman, Steve Ministeri, that I was referring to, I would not underestimate what a huge asset he is. I mean, Steve really is an incredibly savvy strategist. He and Rand Paul go back to, I think, high school. They've been friends a long time.
The 70s. They're young conservatives of Texas is
right.
How they know each other.
And so there's certainly a bond there. But apart from the bond, you want to be surrounded and have loyal people on your team. Ministeri has been, I think, unusually forward-thinking as a strategist for Texas Republicans. How are we going to grow the party? I think that there's an alignment between what Ministeri was preaching for several years to the Republicans in Texas about we can't just be the old fusty establishment country club conservatives. We need to grow the party that really aligns with Rand Paul's outreach and efforts to go. I mean, you don't see Republican candidates going to Detroit to talk about, you know, urban renewal, except for Rand Paul. You don't see the kind of youth outreach. You may hear some of them talking about, we need to appeal to youth and we need to improve the economy so that more people have jobs and they're not stuck in their parents' basements or whatever. But you don't see them as actively reaching out directly and getting traction with young voters as you do with Rand Paul. So that's something to watch.
Assuming he does intend to declare, former Governor Rick Perry is certainly biding his time. Does it make sense for him, after what happened in 2012, to sort of hold back for a while and let everybody else beat each other up before he makes the decision to officially declare a candidacy?
I don't know that that is what's driving his timing. I mean, it may be that he's holding back as he builds his campaign team and his policy team, and he wants to come out strong once he's a formal official candidate. Although I have to say, I mean, call me jaded, but now that, and this was part of Ted Cruz's plan, is once Ted Cruz became the first to announce, and he did it in front of 11,000 people at Liberty University, captive audience or not, it is kind of a come down to hear any of the candidates who are, you know, testing the waters actually announce. Well, we know that they're running. So I don't think there's going to be an enormous amount of excitement for Perry once he announces or not. I don't see any reason. People often ask me whether I think Perry is really going to run, whether he's going to drop out, whether he's just playing around and testing. I don't see any reason he wouldn't run. I just don't. He was governor for 14 years. He feels that he is prepared. He has prepared much more carefully and studiously for this round than he did 4 years ago. And I also think, and two other points, he doesn't have anything going for him right now because he's an ex-governor, and he planned it this way. He knew that he'd be out of office and he would have this time in his career and his life to do this. And I also think probably he has something to prove. Whether he manages to go all the way or not, he wants to prove to people that he's not the doofus that we were left with the impression of when he was forced out of the race so comically, tragically, the last time around. So, I mean, he's definitely going to, you'll replay this tape if I prove to be wrong, but he's definitely going to run.
And I just have to agree with him completely. Perry, his stump speech now is just jammed with facts and statistics and historical points. And he's pretty upfront. He wants to prove to people he's not dumb, as a lot of the impression that he left. And what is also fascinating is he cannot, I just can't say enough how great he is interacting with people. And that's something that, even though I grew up in Texas and grew up watching him, I didn't really know until I saw him in Iowa a few months ago. And he doesn't have responsibilities. He doesn't need to get to votes or deal with state business. So he is just working the most remote corners of Iowa and New Hampshire, and he's hitting up the VFW halls, casually noting that he's one of only two vets in the race. And so, you know, when you are in the mountains of New Hampshire and other campaigns don't come through or candidates, it means something to those people. And so, again, if the vote is so splintered and enough people who have met Rick Perry show up to the polls, you never know what could happen in February of next year.
Right. And the structure of presidential contests plays to his strengths. Iowa and New Hampshire being the first states, these are retail states. It makes a big difference. It is not tragic to go into a diner and have 20 people to talk to. In fact, it's helpful because the people who come out are networked with other people who are probably going to turn out in the caucuses in Iowa or the primary in New Hampshire. And it just plays to Rick Perry's strength. Now, he has to have, as they all do, to capitalize on however well they do in those early states, he's going to have the money and the campaign structure in place to quickly ramp up if he does well enough in Iowa and New Hampshire and then South Carolina and Nevada to make a splash probably March 1st in Texas and the half dozen other states.
How are his likely Republican primary opponents going to characterize what's been called the Texas miracle? And how do you sort of cut that down without alienating Texas voters who, whether they like Rick Perry or not, believe that it's a phenomenon and that they have benefited from it?
I haven't heard much chatter about that specific issue. I think with the Texas miracle, what will be interesting is how the oil prices hold up, how that affects the state economy, and whether or not. And I would expect a Democrat would be more likely to use that argument. I can say this. Rick Perry is polling dismally in the single digits. That doesn't mean that much right now. It's not good, but I can say that his opponents are nervous about him. They're nervous enough to make it clear to me that when he messes things up, if that makes sense. So I think he is still matters in that they're watching him closely with a little bit of skittishness.
And they're holding back on any real attacks on the Texas miracle until he makes a run, you know, and until he builds up in the polls.
Hang on to that ammunition until they
right.
feel like they need it.
Right.
The other former governor in the race with Texas ties, of course, is Jeb Bush. And I'm curious as to how much you think the former Florida governor will highlight, downplay his relationship to two former presidents.
Well, I think they're being very calculated. They've thought it through. I don't think it's an accident that we've seen W saying I'm his biggest albatross, or however he says it. Everyone knows that the Jeb's relationship with W is going to be problematic because people feel uncomfortable about a dynasty. The conservative grassroots are not huge fans of either of the presidents Bush. So that part of the legacy is problematic. And, you know, it's a trade-off. He can't change the fact that he's a Bush. He can take advantage of the network of donors and supporters in the states that are important in the contests, and also the ATM type, you know, folks in Texas. It's a trade-off. It's a big shadow. I don't think it's an accident, for instance. I'm I'm not sure I can prove this, but I don't think it's an accident that the Republican Party chose not to put the convention in Dallas, because I think that there was a thought that down the road, if it ends up, and this is really past the primary, this would never have had any impact on the primary, but I think there was a thought among some power brokers within the Republican establishment that if Jeb gets the nomination, it would just reinforce this connection with W in the minds of general election voters if he is coronated right there in W's backyard in Dallas. So everyone knows that there is a shadow that Jeb needs to escape from. Jeb certainly knows that. And the Bush family is projecting humility about, we're not a dynasty, I've got to earn it, he's got to earn it, all of that.
I think what's also interesting, and it is very much a trade-off, I am still very skeptical of how far the Bush name can take you in this era. But what's so fascinating is that you have George W. Bush in Dallas, you have George H.W. Bush in Houston, and you have former cabinet member and close family friend Don Evans in Midland. So Jeb Bush has this amazing geographic network of the three fundraising centers in the state. And he has like a very, very close family member or family friend there able to advocate for him. And, you know, I've talked to donors and I've talked to political operatives in Austin, and there's still a deep well of loyalty to the Bushes that I don't think can be underestimated. It may not manifest itself in the votes in a Texas primary, but it certainly will infrastructure-wise.
Jumping to the Democratic Party for a while, Abby, you think Hillary Clinton will be spending a lot of time in Texas?
I think it's relative, but I think I would not be surprised to see her blow through the state periodically on fundraising. There is a trial lawyer couple in Houston who are major Democratic donors. They're named the Mostyns, and there's plenty of people in Dallas who will donate. And so Texas is a Republican state. There's no doubt about it, but there's still a lot of Democratic money there.
Right. And one point that I always try to make to people, even a state like Texas, which is a Republican state, as Abby says, no question, it is a Republican state. Any state that is an X state or a Y state has both. It's an overlay, and it's just a question of who's dominant. It doesn't mean that there's nothing to be gotten there. And for Hillary, you know, she's already planting seeds. She has one staffer for at least a month to do some organizing. I'm a little skeptical about what difference that'll make. And she doesn't have any particular problem in the primary, at least for now. But she could ramp up pretty easily. She has a lot of friends there. She and Bill were very active in the McGovern campaign. They cut their teeth in 72 in Texas. They have a lot of friends from that era, people who went on to become U.S. attorney in Dallas and land commissioner. I mean, people who are, you know, out of sight right now, but they have a network that they can tap. And Bill certainly, you know, he spent a lot of time in Dallas. There is money to be had, and there are people that they can activate as an organization. Now, is that going to turn Texas purple next time around? I don't think so. Democrats might say so. I think that would be premature. They can certainly hope that Hillary will use next year's campaign to energize them. The Obama-Clinton rivalry in 2008 juiced up Democrats quite a bit, although it didn't really pay off in any statewide contests since then for them. But it was exactly the kind of thing that Texas Democrats need and will need to rebuild.
I would just add that the Clintons are just known to give tender, loving care to the state parties, even the ones who don't matter, and they much more so than President Obama does. And so there is hope that they can help make inroads in the future. And the Democrats are now starting to hearken back to what Howard Dean, as party chairman, had called the 50-state strategy, which is putting an infrastructure into these red states so that in case the stars align and they're able to get a Senate candidate who could win, they have the infrastructure there to make it happen.
Elizabeth Warren is a very different kind of candidate or potential candidate. She grew up in Oklahoma, spent years in Houston. Her recent memoir, A Fighting Chance, describes how teaching at the UT Austin Law School really honed her focus on bankruptcy laws and people struggling to get by. How much of a role do you think she will play nationally in 2016? She has said, no way, no how.
I think her main goal right now is to push Hillary as far to the left as she can while still making her electable. And it's there, it is still fascinating to me how there are not that many divisions in the Democratic Party right now. I mean, there just seems to be kind of an assumption Hillary will be the nominee, and there's not a division like we saw in 06. Granted, that was over a war in Iraq, but I think her main goal is just we see it playing out in this trade deal. There is this massive trade deal with the Pacific Ocean and Pacific Rim countries. And so seeing she's definitely kept Hillary from being 100% free trade, from my view.
I think that's right. Yeah. I mean, that she Elizabeth Warren is there waiting to pounce just in case Hillary implodes. And her presence and everything that she says and does is a stopper, as Abby is describing. I mean, there's really not much of a plan B. I mean, there's Martin O'Malley, who is, even in Maryland, people don't really know the ex-governor a whole lot. There is no particular plan B among Democrats.
What sort of appeal does Hillary Clinton have to Latino voters who traditionally go with the Democratic Party?
I'm not sure the answer to that. Bill Clinton was beloved. I mean, he would go down to the Valley, and he would draw huge crowds, very popular down there. And Hillary, I mean, there is a well of support down there for her as well.
I've never actually understood it, and that's something that I should get to know better. But and I've written about it actually. But she there is just a bet that she will boost Latino turnout. And the place where that matters most in Texas, if it's true and if all happens in a general election, is the Texas 23rd Congressional District, which is the only truly competitive district in the state. And there's a rematch brewing between Congressman Will Hurd, a Republican, and Democrat Pete Gallego. And so most people believe Gallego lost that race based on turnout. And so if she can boost the Latino turnout there, that is the hope that Democrats can pick up the one seat that they have a shot in Texas.
But she would really have to have a lot of excess time on her hands to bother with that particular race. I mean, yeah.
It just could, her name on the ballot.
Just a name on the ballot. It would help. Yes, absolutely.
We're speaking this hour with two journalists. We have Abby Livingston, Washington correspondent for the Texas Tribune, and Todd Gilman, Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. We're talking about perceptions of Texas in the nation's capital. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with two journalists who cover events in the nation's capital for Texas-based publications. Abby Livingston is Washington correspondent for the Texas Tribune. Todd Gilman is Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. The Washington Correspondents' Dinner was this weekend. Todd, you're on the board.
The White House Correspondents' Association, yes.
Talk about how the event comes together, and is it something that you just cannot miss if you are here in Washington as a journalist?
Well, I confess that I enjoy going to this thing. It is goofy in a lot of ways, and it gets criticized in a lot of ways for being this crazy celebrity over-the-top thing. More than 2,600 people attend it, including the president, much of the cabinet, the press secretary, and the White House press corps primarily. At its core, the event is about celebrating press freedom. We also give out a pretty substantial amount of scholarship money. I'm really proud to be associated with it. I think that it is a wonderful opportunity for reporters and the people that they cover to get together and socialize and relax a little bit and share some laughs, share some food, which any beat reporter goes out and has dinner and has coffee with folks. We just do it in black tie for this particular night. But it's an event that commands the commander-in-chief's attention to come and publicly profess his support for the ideal of transparency and accountability and press access and freedom. And I think that's a terrific thing.
Even if he pretends to do that with a sort of tongue-in-cheek spirit.
Anyway, as always, I want to close on a more serious note. You know, I often joke about tensions between me and the press, but honestly, what they say doesn't bother me. I understand we've got an adversarial system. I'm a mellow sort of guy. And that's why I invited Luther, my anger translator, to join me here tonight. Hold on to your lily white butts. In our fast-changing world, traditions like the White House Correspondents' Dinner are important.
I mean, really? What is this dinner? And why am I required to come to it? Jeb Bush, do you really want to do this?
Because despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense.
That was President Obama and actor Keegan-Michael Key at the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend. We are speaking this hour with two Washington correspondents for Texas-based papers, Todd Gilman and Abby Livingston. Is the entertainment kept secret ahead of time so that you really get the full impact?
Well, that we did not know about the anger translator at all. The MC of the night, Cecily Strong from Saturday Night Live, was announced. She was chosen by the White House Correspondents Association president many months ago, and they always pick, you know, some major stand-up comic or entertainer. The presidents often come with some kind of secret weapon. It's a video or some crazy slideshow, or sometimes George W. Bush came with a George W. Bush impersonator who was really dead on. It's fun. They poke fun. There were some kind of pointed jokes Obama had about Ted Cruz in particular, about how Cruz has compared himself to Galileo, but Galileo thought the Earth revolves around the sun and Ted Cruz thinks the world revolves around him, you know, that kind of stuff. It can get a little pointed, but it's supposed to be, it's like a roast.
Is there any sense that you have to be careful of what you laugh at more than something else?
Oh, I think the journalists in the room are very careful about what they are seen laughing at. Yes, absolutely.
That I've seen already today. There are C-SPAN's there, and the camera pans the crowd. And like, if you have the wrong look on your face, or someone was on their BlackBerry during the Pledge of Allegiance, and that screenshot
that was
put up.
That was not nice.
But yeah. I'm less keen on the event, and I did not go this year, but what I would say is I'm still on the younger end of reporting, so it's not always a guarantee I get to go, but I went. My first one was in 2011, and that was the night before the Osama bin Laden raid, and the president was bluffing the entire dinner, just pretending everything was calm when his entire presidency was on the line. And so that's one of the rare moments that I've had in Washington that wasn't manufactured, where there really was something fascinating from a news person's point of view, and just getting to watch that play out and then the next day go, oh my gosh, he knew this was all going down. And that's kind of one of the one really good parts of being a reporter, are those sorts of moments.
That was incredible. And I will say, as a regional newspaper, I'm not, you know, representing ABC or Fox or Bloomberg or one of the big organizations that brings movie stars in. We never bring movie stars in. I confess we invited Tony Romo once, and he was a great guest, as was his wife Candace. They're terrific. But most White House reporters bring sources. It's a time to share a laugh with a cabinet member, if you can score one of those, or somebody from the press office who has worked with you. I mean, there's a lot of, it's a symbiotic relationship. They try to spin us, but we need information from them. And you can't be adversarial 24/7, 365. You have to have relationships with these people. It's how the world works. It's certainly how journalism and politics work. It's how Washington works. And so it is a useful tool that in some ways has become distorted by certain things.
So you have to choose your celebrity date carefully, is what you're saying.
Yes. I've been tempted to try to invite some Texas-based celebrity, but really I'd much rather have the ambassador from Mexico, or we've had the HUD secretary, people with Texas connections. We had the governor this year as our guest, Governor Abbott. He was a terrific guest. Unfortunately, I didn't get to sit next to him because I was up at the head table, but he was gracious enough to come up here, and that's great.
I will shamelessly admit that I almost booked Richard Simmons, but he canceled on us last year when I was at Roll Call. So I was really excited about that, too.
I came close to inviting Lyle Lovett this year, but I didn't. Big fan. Big fan, Lyle. If you want to come, call me.
Todd, you've done a lot of reporting recently on King v. Burwell, which the Supreme Court is expected to rule on this summer. It hinges on the language in the Affordable Care Act that refers to states creating insurance marketplaces?
Yes. So I'm no expert on this. The bottom line is the dispute over whether Congress really meant to have this huge loophole and say, well, only if the state creates the marketplace does the state get money from the federal government. The administration's point of view is, of course, that's a ridiculous stance. It was never intended that way. There's lots of other parts of the statute that suggest otherwise. It would be a game changer if this went against the administration.
Specifically for Texans, there would be a large number of people who currently have subsidized coverage that would lose access to that. Is that right?
Yes. I don't off the top of my head remember the number of people. But Texas, when you talk about the insurance marketplace and you talk about the lack of uninsured Americans, Texas kind of is the problem, which is why President Obama has been to Texas a number of times and stumped for it and tried to enlist allies like Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins and others, because Texas has almost a quarter of its residents uninsured. If you could solve – and Texas is enormous. And so if you could solve the uninsured problem in Texas, you have made a huge dent in the overall problem of uninsured.
Well, I just add, I think if this ruling goes against the administration, there will be – an interesting dynamic with the Republican-controlled Congress. How do they unwind this legislation without creating chaos? And so that's the thing that I'm going to be most fascinated with if this happens in the way Republicans hope it will, which I honestly have no sense either way.
What about the same-sex marriage arguments the Supreme Court hears tomorrow? How could that change the landscape nationally, and what would change in Texas, depending on the outcome?
Boy, it will be – it's going to set off – backlash, regardless of which way that goes. We've both heard Ted Cruz has been very vocal, in particular, about the idea that same-sex marriage or marriage laws should be left to the states, that there should be pure federalism. This has always been left to the states. The federal government and federal courts shouldn't have a role in deciding rules on marriage. I personally don't understand how a patchwork of marriage laws works, because people are totally portable, and you could live in a state that has legal same-sex marriage and move to a state that bans same-sex marriage, and you would have a rather odd situation if you wanted to divorce or adopt or have health insurance benefits. So I think the Supreme Court is going to have to do something that is going to tick off a lot of people and will cause a big backlash.
Is the evangelical Christian vote in Texas more powerful than the evangelical Christian vote in the United States overall?
I would guess yes, just from my personal experiences in Texas, and that is my assumption. I haven't seen any empirical data of that, but I know the people I grew up around and my experiences, and I think of the evangelical vote as extremely powerful in Texas. And I've had one person say to me that they think that sometimes Tea Party and evangelical people use Tea Party when they mean evangelical. And so I think we saw a lot of it with Ted Cruz's Senate race.
There's there's been a merging, and in some states, when the Tea Party movement arose, it was purely about fiscal issues in some places. But in Texas, it really has had an enormous overlap. And some people use the term tevangelical. There's really a very, very big overlap in Texas that may not exist elsewhere. I mean, when you go to Iowa, there's a more discreet separation between Tea Partiers and evangelicals who are very involved in the caucus process there. But if you're a conservative in Texas, you're probably social conservative, and you're probably religiously conservative as well.
This is just a speculation here, for the sake of this question, but if Senator Ted Cruz were to win the Republican nomination, would the party, like, back him, the party faithful, or, you know, rather than risk another Democrat in the White House?
His entire case is he is Reagan in 1980, that he will paint in bold colors and not pale pastels. And so his argument is, give me the nomination. We did it with McCain. We did it with Mitt Romney, who he would probably call squishes, moderates.
Moderate Republicans.
Yes, and the evangelical base stayed home. So if you nominate me, there will be a whole bunch of evangelicals who didn't come out the last several presidential races who will come out for me. So that's his case. I don't know if it'll true, but...
The Democrats, if the Democrats nominate Hillary Clinton, Republicans will coalesce behind whoever ends up with the nomination. The non-Tea Partiers, the non-evangelicals, will fight to the bitter end to block Ted Cruz from getting that nomination. But if he manages to thread the needle and get the nomination, they will hold their nose. Some of them won't hold their nose. They will pour money into his campaign, whatever it takes. He'll be better. This is the way politics always works. It's better than the other guy. Better, or in this case, maybe better than the woman on the other side. Sure, he'll get plenty of support if he manages, but that's the big if. How does he get the nomination?
Is there anything about the state of the Tea Party today that suggests that there will be, at some point in the future, a real bifurcation of the GOP so that there are two separate parties there?
I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing the other more traditional American pattern of a third party, which, of course, the Tea Party never was a third party, but of these strains that erupt and then get subsumed and absorbed and even co-opted by whatever party they sprung from. I mean, there was a time, I never believed it, but, you know, Dick Armey used to go around saying Tea Party is not Republican, we're not Democrat. Well, it was always a creature of the Republican Party. Maybe they attracted a few Democrats, but it was always a purified form of something. Fiscal conservatism, libertarianism, evangelicalism, you know, a mishmash of things, populism. And it particularly in the congressional wing of the Republican Party, it is very influential already, particularly in the House.
Todd Gilman is Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Abby Livingston is originally from Fort Worth. She is Washington correspondent for the Texas Tribune. It's been wonderful to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Oh,
thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Our think team in Washington includes producer Stephen Becker, executive producer Jeff Whittington, and KERA's vice president of news, Rick Holter. We had Elizabeth Ockley engineering from D.C. today, and we want to thank all the people from NPR who are making this week possible. Back in Dallas, Think is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Christina Martinez answered phones today. You can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC and get a look at behind-the-scenes action on our new Tumblr. It's at kerathink.tumblr.com. And you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd in Washington this week. Thanks for listening and have a great day.